You're listening to Face Off, episode 79, recorded July 26, 2010. Welcome to Face Off, your face-to-face web technology podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Jade Robbins.
And I'm Mark Sanborn.
And in this podcast, we try to talk about as much as we can about web technology, such as web development, social media, and web entrepreneurship. As always, you can view our show notes by going to faceoffshow.com. All right, Mark, another week. So here's a kind of a fun thing to talk about, I guess, just not really related to web technology, but we both just got kittens.
Kittens. They're so cute.
Yeah, they are. They're pretty fun. It's kind of like a funny story, like how this happened, though. My wife, Amber, was kind of like, I want a cat. And I think it was last week we were hanging out over Skype talking about the show or working or something anyways. But she's like, I'm going to go look at these kittens. And you just heard her and you're just like, hey, give me one.
Yeah, I kind of impulse kittened.
Well, you've had cats before and stuff. You like cats
a lot.
Yeah, I have. So it's nice. I don't know. I mean, kittens are fun. They're really cute. But I kind of like adult cats, too. I kind of wish that it would, because it's pretty hyper right now.
Yeah, they're hyper.
And it's cute. But it's hard to say no. They're pretty cute. But anyway, so we both have fun kittens now. I miss having pets. We used to have a lot when I was growing up as a kid. So it's kind of nice to have one back in the house, even though he may be kind of a pain in the butt sometimes. All right. So the next kind of follow-up or news thing I want to talk to you about, I'm curious if, so this week, we had this thing at work where my boss like had a cabin that she had rented for some family to come down or something, and they ended up not being able to make it. So she had it for an extra couple of days. So we actually went up, like eight of us at work, our team at work, and had a work retreat, which was really cool. I'm kind of curious what your thoughts on it are, if you've ever done one or anything like this, Mark. But basically, it's like we got to go hang out Sunday night with each other, you know, all of us at work or all coworkers, and just play around and have fun and have a good time. And then Monday morning, we all woke up and like started doing some work and did some strategic planning. And I think they're a really good idea, because it's pretty unique that you're not at work, you're there, you kind of have a goal, like this is what we want to focus on. Everybody, you know, you can kind of hang out and get coffee and stuff. You're not at your desk. You're kind of all sitting around a table. And I think that's an environment that you don't get at work. You just can't find at work, even if you do have like a conference room that you registered all day or something. You know, it's just this nice attitude of being able to get away.
Yeah, you're away from all the distractions. You know, if the server room gets overheated or whatever, there's no fixing it out in the woods. So, yeah, it's great. I have had an experience like that. As an RTA for working at the university, we had to go to a big team building camp that was like a 2 or 3 day event, and it was pretty cool getting out there. You kind of get to know your coworkers and stuff and see what they kind of do outside of work.
Yeah, that's really fun. Yeah, you're like, it was kind of fun this morning. Like, we all kind of woke up and we're like walking around in our pajamas with like our like messed up bed head, you know, that from sleeping out. I didn't sleep in the cabin though. I actually brought my backpacking tent and pitched it outside because I wanted, you know, new stuff. It's always fun to play with.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, on that sort of same note, it's kind of funny. You and I and our friend Rob Lund, we're working on a project right now, and it's kind of funny. It's like anytime we go backpacking when there isn't, you know, just us three, it is almost kind of like a retreat for our project every time, because we always end up talking about it, but it's not like you're talking about it while working on or anything like that. You're just kind of out in the solitude of the woods, and you just kind of end up talking about sort of like your strategic plan for the future, and it works out really nice. I like it. Let's get into our geek tool of the week. So I don't know about you, Mark, but at my house, we use the fridge for more than just chilling food. It also ends up being sort of a central part of the house where we hang up a lot of stuff on it, a lot of papers, things that we, you know, don't want to lose or things we need quick references for. I'm not sure if you do that, but the problem with my wife and I is that we end up doing it so much that after a while, there's a lot of papers on there. You end up getting like 4 or 5. What we found is, you know, most magnets can't handle it. So you get those, you know, a cheap magnet from Walmart or you know, like the Papa John's, you know, this is how you remember our phone number, so order more pizza magnet. And they're usually really cheap and they don't hold stuff up. So our geek tool this week is rare earth refrigerator pins. They're these, the rare earth magnets are like really strong magnets. I don't know why they're called rare earth or anything like that. But what these are, they look like little push pins, but they have rare earth magnets on the bottom. And the benefit to that is you can use them to hang stuff up on your fridge more than your average magnet.
Yeah, it says here it can lift 10 sheets of paper or 1 pound for one little tiny magnet. It says they're actually being world famous for their amazing lift to weight ratios. So these are pretty strong magnets.
So they are rare, and they're from the Earth. So, you know, unless they're from
space. And they look like little, like, thumbtacks.
Yeah, so they're really cute. You put them up. You know, there's also, if you search on Amazon, if you follow our link, you'll get to them. But there's also, like, options at the bottom for other ones that don't look just like push pins. But these ones are pretty nice. They're really strong. I have a couple. I don't know if they're rare earth, but I have a couple of these magnets that we used to use for our name tags when I at a place I used to work, and so we just kind of have the backings, which has the magnet on it, and we put them up in our fridge, and man, they really stick to it. And I'm assuming the rare earth magnets are kind of probably as strong or definitely stronger than this, and those are the best magnets we have. But other than that, like some once in a while, we'll put like some papers up with those really junky magnets, and it drives me nuts because you'll be sitting watching TV and all of a sudden you hear papers fall in the kitchen, and you're like, what's going on in there?
Yeah, I think I remember trying to take that one off, and like I thought it was glued on there. It wasn't budget.
So they're pretty strong. You can get these; it's pretty cheap for like a pack of eight. What is it, like $5, I think. But you know, check it out if you put stuff on your fridge. I don't know. Do you like hang papers on your fridge and stuff?
I definitely don't utilize my refrigerator surface space like you do. I need to start probably putting stuff up there. Yeah. Reminders, you know, to do, but. I think I have an app for that to-do stuff coming up.
Uh-oh. So. Yeah, I mean, like, we do bills and stuff, like, or if you have, like, roommates, right? A lot of times with roommates, you put, like, the bill on the fridge, but the problem is if you get, like, 5 or 6 bills, you need either you have to spread them out all over the thing, and then your fridge is covered in bills, and you're like, it's, you know, maybe that's the point, but, like, for us, it's nice to just kind of put them all in one pile and then stick it with a nice strong magnet on the fridge.
Maybe I can take some pictures of my little kitten and magnet them on
there. You go, put a little cut out little red hearts from red construction paper to put around it as a there frame, and yeah, wow, you love your kitten. I love mine too. They're great. All right, that's our Geek Tool of the Week. Hey, we're going to talk about our web apps later because our web apps really relate to our topic this week. But if you guys have a web app or some news or follow-up or even a topic idea that you want us to talk to, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Let us know. We'd love to hear from you guys. Last week we talked about two things that were submitted by one of our listeners, Philip Downer. So let us know. Please go tweet us out, send us an email, anything. We'd love to hear from you guys. All right, Mark, let's get into our topic this week. This is something that we're thinking about right now in our projects that we're working on, and it's load testing.
All right, so load testing, load testing can mean a few different things. We're going to be talking about basically web load testing. So, right. You know, web-specific software, you know, web technology podcast. We're not talking about mechanical load testing. We're not talking about software benchmark load testing.
Is that what we do here? I kind of forgot. Where's my script?
Where's my notes?
Yeah, so web load testing, I mean... it's something to think about. You hear about it in the web all the time. People, they start a company, it gets popular, and it just kind of goes down the tubes. And that's probably because they didn't do proper load testing, or they didn't do load testing for the amount of users that actually came. Right.
Mm-hmm. You also might in the same kind of realm of things, you might hear the term stress testing, which for our purposes, we're going to basically combine the two. Stress testing, technically, from what I could tell, was basically taking your highest peak and maybe doubling that, something that's above and beyond normal operating, you know, or even your best, or I mean your most loaded times, and really trying to break the system and cause problems.
So like load testing is like, this is what we expect to have. Can our app just handle, you know, a normal load? Stress testing is where it's like, all right, now we're used to 5,000 users concurrently. Let's crank it up to 50 and then see what you know, springs a leak.
Yeah, and I think it's useful to do both. So we're going to kind of talk about them as if they're the same thing. So specifically for stress testing, you know, it's useful to test for, you know, peaks, holiday sales, or seasonal type things if you're an e-commerce site. Other things like Dig and Reddit, those are classic. Any social media where you could potentially get 1 million visitors in a day where you normally get 1,000.
Yeah,
you
know, I mean,
you want to kind of test for that stuff.
The holiday thing is something good to think about too, because we can, I mean, I guess I tend to think of like a Digger Reddit where it's like, I have a blog and all of a sudden, bro, I'm getting a ton of traffic. But I mean, if just your business, you might have a normal load during one time of the year, and then you might have a higher load during another time of the year, like at the holidays. And those, you know, you want to test both those loads as well, you know, do load testing for that as well. And then, you know, like if you turn out, you get put on like the front of like Slick Deals or some site like that, you know, then you want to do stress testing, because that's kind of like the Digger Reddit of, you know, an e-commerce app.
That's a very good point. So we kind of know what it is. Why should we even care about doing it? The first obvious reason comes to mind is that nobody really likes a slow site. You know, if it's taking 10 seconds to load a page, I'm out of there, you know, not going to wait around. I might think it's my internet connection because it has been pretty flaky lately, but if it's continuously slow, I'm not going to like your site.
Well, I mean, we've talked about this before with like Yahoo stuff. They really focus on trying to load something in the viewable frame immediately. And it's something they really focus on because, I mean, didn't they say something like, I mean, if it takes more than, you know, 500 milliseconds before the user sees something happen, they're out. And so, that's, you know, their thing is like, you want to see something right now, because then you see something happening at least. If you see progress, you know, that's better than nothing. And so their kind of focus is that, you know, web users are very fickle. If it doesn't work, you know, I'm out. I don't want to deal with it. So if I'm noticing that I have to wait at all, I'm you know, as generic web user, I'm very impatient, because the whole point of the web is it's fast as the speed of light, you know?
Yeah, I was in prepping for the show, I was looking for an actual research paper about how people don't like long response times. But then I was like, you know, this is just silly. It's like, it's nobody really. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
We did have we did talk about a study in a previous podcast about people like scrolling real fast and clicking on links and like not really reading or scanning. They're moving fast. So, and if they can't scan and move fast, they kind of get impatient,
right,
and try to leave.
Right.
Another reason to do this is Google has now officially said that it factors page load time in its ranking system. So if you consistently have a slow site, Google will, you know, give you a demerit or mark, you know, put negative points towards your page rank. So that's never a good thing if you're not showing up in search results, especially if you're trying to make some money on your site.
Totally.
Or just get out there, get your content out there. So make sure it's fast, a little, you know, fast. Later in the podcast, we talk about a tool that actually comes from Google that helps you monitor your speeds over time. Other things that you can find, and two of these I found personally myself, they kind of go together, memory leaks and improper server configs. I have a virtual private host, which we talked about hosts in a previous podcast too, which is basically a private, you get your own set of resources on a host, and you usually get a very small amount of RAM, because that's usually the thing that, you know, it's the most scarce.
Right. I mean, CPU kind of goes in and out, but usually, I mean, an operating system sort of needs a base chunk of RAM, and then, you know, the RAM tends to fluctuate less than the CPU.
Yeah, and since you're not sharing the same Apache-like instance, you have your own everything, you're using a lot of the RAM just to be up and running.
To be alive, yeah.
So anyways, you only have a certain amount. My virtual private host is small, or my memory portion of it is pretty small. And I only had, let's say, 30 or 40 megabytes free, and the server config I found, I didn't read carefully enough, and I had it set to give like to start us like a new instance for every like keep two alive or something. And it ended up basically taking up all my RAM when like five people came to my site, which so the sixth person that comes gets a super, super slow site. And anyways, I changed the config file, tweaked it a little bit, and now it can take thousands at the same time. So, that one, you know, if you do a quick load test, you would find that little problem right away. It's a problem that you probably don't want to have if you can only have five people at a time on your site.
Yeah, exactly.
So little things like that can make a big difference. So the next thing is testing you can kind of test these things all in once, or you can kind of split it up and test it by different layers of the web application.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of like there's different chunks to your application, and while if you did do sort of a whole application testing, you'll find sort of, you know, systemic problems, but you can head off a lot of these at the pass. So like, you know, if you want to do something like, you know, you could use RSpec or your sort of unit test or your integration test to do things like, if you wanted to, you know, make a mock of your data item, make a mock of it so it isn't actually hitting your database or anything like that, and then just hit the application. Then you'll find things like bottlenecks in your code, like if you have a really inefficient algorithm. And so you could, you know, just test sort of the application by itself, and then you could sort of move on to the next, you know, or just, you know, hit the next layer of like just stress testing your database. Things like indexes in your database can be really important. You know, if you're hitting something a lot and it's not indexed properly, it'll, you know, higher load will definitely show that. So doing stress testing just on your database, which, you know, I mean, there's tools out there to do that as well. You can find like in our show notes. There's like a MySQL one that they recommend from MySQL themselves, correct?
Yeah, it's the MySQL stress test. It's a little Perl application, and from what I can tell, I mean, it's on the MySQL.com website. It's the official stress test for it. So
yeah,
check that one out. I haven't ran that one personally, but it looks like it stresses your database.
Yeah, or I mean, and so then also not just your application, your database, but any sort of other component, if you can try and do a load or a stress test on it, that just gives you good, you know, good confidence before you launch. Because I mean, usually your internal testing is five people, you know, there's five of us in the office and we're playing around with it, and maybe we all hit the same instance, but maybe not. So you might want to test anything like, you know, we had a project at work where we were doing, you know, email provisioning with Google, and when it came down to, we were going to have to, you know, provision thousands of people, it's nice to do like sort of a stress test, or we were doing some mail routing too for thousands and thousands of mails. So it's kind of like, let's send some fake emails and really hammer it and make sure it's robust enough before we go live with it. Because what you find, like we see with a lot of web apps, is you go live and then it, you know, kind of collapses. So we kind of buckle underneath the pressure.
You know, also, I just thought of it. We're going to get to the apps in a second, but I thought of one that I wanted to mention right now as we're talking about it is the Boomerang script that we talked about two episodes ago from Yahoo will also help this. And that's kind of on the client side. So it's another, you could kind of think of it as another layer.
Right. I mean, we were talking about it, but you know, like what is like load and stress testing? It's just put demand on the system and measure a response. So any metrics or information you can get from that are very helpful. So even if you're getting client side metrics, that tells you like, well, my, you know, even if you're unable to get sort of server side metrics, you can say, well, I use something like Boomerang and say, my clients are getting an average load of this time, you know, and that's not good with only this many users. Maybe I need to figure it out.
And that factors in their connection speeds and things too.
Yeah, totally.
So
I mean, what are some useful metrics that we can get from like load or stress testing?
Well, one of them that you know that comes to mind is requests per second. You know, how many people can we get right now, right this second, all at the same time? Another one is like queries per second. This is usually whatever your database, or maybe you have a document DB, or you know how many queries if. Like Twitter, for example, how many, you know, they can have a lot more people on the page surfing around, but when people are posting stuff up,
right,
you know, that takes some more resources. So
totally.
Queries per second, latency in milliseconds. If it's taking 10 seconds to load a page, it's not good. Throughput in bytes per second. So this is especially useful for content serving sites like YouTube. If the, you know, it's taking a really long time to get the movie, you know, the little video clip going, people are not going to stick around for very long. So if you're serving up content or offering files for download, definitely make sure you're offering some decent speeds there.
It's funny. I was talking about this sort of at work today. There is almost two types of data when you talk about like, you know, web stuff, or it's just data in general. There's sort of this informational metadata type stuff, which is like sort of things that are in your database, and there's sort of just hardcore content data, right? Like, you know, we always talk about like you need to make sure your database is optimized, but also you get a lower YSLO score if you're just sort of raw files aren't hosted on a content delivery network. And that's kind of the difference. Like you don't usually you don't sort of have like a cloud, you know, database delivery network, you know, service that you would use, but you know, you might do that internally, but you need, that's like a different thing, is to make sure your database is ready. And then that other type of data, which is just sort of raw redundant data.
Yep. So then we're going to kind of get into the tools. I want to preface that with, there's two kind of types of tools. There's the kind of just hammer one URL, nothing special. These tools are really easy. They're usually just a one little command line or so, and it will just pretend like there's 5,000 users hitting the URL all at the same time.
Right.
They're pretty easy to use. And then there's actual kind of, they're kind of systems integration.
Like smarter tools,
tests,
right?
Like
I mean, there's kind of the dumb tool that's just like, gimme. And then these are kind of like, I know about your app. You know, the other one is just sort of like, I'm just hitting this website, or I'm hitting this thing. And then the other one is kind of like, I have more information about your system, so I'm going to navigate your system.
Yeah, these can even like open browsers and click around and stuff. So we'll get into our tools. And the first one is AB, which comes with Apache. So this should be installed on any server that has Linux.
Mm-hmm.
That one is pretty much specifically for just hammering a single page.
Like, yeah, just we're not going to do anything fancy. Just what, you know, what kind of load from just hits can you get to a website?
Yep. Pilot is another one that we're going to talk about, and it's an open source app. I saw a mention that it might have been the one behind one of the web apps we're going to talk about, but I'm not sure. So
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure one of those, it wouldn't surprise me if one, you know, some web apps use these tools at all.
All right. Another one is JMeter. I saw this one suggested on Stack Overflow by a lot of people. I've actually used this one before. It's Java based, so it'll run Windows, Linux, you know, anywhere that Java runs.
Yeah.
And you can set up, I mean, this one's kind of, it can be simple and it can be complex. You can actually set up to do logins and different things.
Right.
But it's good at just hammering, you know, I mean, and it, you know, this one actually can test more than just HTTP. It can do FTP and mail.
Oh, cool.
And actual SOAP. So if you have an API that uses the SOAP protocol, you can test that.
Wow, that's great.
So that one, it's, so then I want to jump down to Selenium, which is more of an in-browser test. We've talked about Selenium in a podcast previously.
Right.
But what Selenium allows you to do is it literally opens up a browser and browses the page using, I think, JavaScript. And it can actually click on things and interact with JavaScript elements and like fill in forms, drag and drop. I'm not sure about drag and drop, but
I mean, it can basically do any interaction that your mouse can. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I think the whole point with some of it, you know, I know there's two types of Selenium. We had Eric Wendelin talk about this. There's like Selenium Core and Selenium RC or something. And then Selenium Core is kind of like, I record a macro almost. Like I go and I click through the website and then it does it again. And Selenium RC is like a way to sort of programmatically do that and then actually set it up as like tests. So this is kind of like, you know, this is like the end level of user interface testing, right? You say like, when I click this and do this, it should take me to this page, you know, and this, you should have this text displayed like success. And then that's like sort of the end full stack testing of like, you know, the back end's working and the front end also works as well, you know?
So yeah, I mean, we talked about this with Eric Wendelin in episode 16. It's kind of a systems integration test. It tests as if it was the user. You can actually load up different browsers even. So with Selenium, by itself, it's not a load testing framework, but if you have your Selenium like script that you would already write to make sure your site is up and working functionally, you can actually send it off to Selenium Grid or the web app that we're going to talk about, and it can actually send that script to multiple computers and have them all hit the site at the same time.
Right. So like if you work in a web shop and have a bunch of computers, you set up a Selenium Grid and then like you schedule it like at night or something like to run a Selenium Grid job, and it sends it off to all those, which hopefully you have a bunch of like different operating systems with different browsers as well, so that you're testing like all that. But at the same time, when you're doing that, if you have a bunch of machines doing it, you're also sort of doing load testing as well. Like let's say here, you know, I have 20 computers in my grid. That's 20 users using the website at once, you know, fairly intensely.
Yeah. So Selenium seems like a good way to go if you, I mean, it's a lot more work intensive to, because you have to write all the tests. A lot of websites, you know, make Selenium tests anyways, and so it's a good to just take right. all those tests and throw them in a grid.
Totally. Yeah, if you have it done anyways.
I would say it's the most, it's the closest to an actual user versus like AB and Pilot, and JMeter can be configured to do a lot of the things that Selenium can do, but it's a little bit more work. Then, like you said, Selenium, you can actually kind of record your clicks. They have like a GUI interface and things.
Yeah.
Makes it a little bit easier to write tests. And again, we talked about that in episode 16, so check that out. Another one is Neoload. I haven't actually tried this one, but I mentioned it because it's one of those big names, Philips, Xerox, Accenture, a lot of big sites are using it for their load testing. So
and they have like
wanted
a
to mention
version.
That one, check it out. It's kind of a paid solution. I think it runs from the cloud, but I'm not sure. But I wanted to mention that one just because it was kind of a big name in the load testing. Yeah,
like the next level.
Yeah. Curl Loader. I checked this one out. This is an open source project that I mentioned this one just because it does everything curl does. So it can actually test SSH, FTP, you know, anything that curl does. Curl supports a ton of stuff. I mean, like GitHub, for example, is a web app that utilizes SSH and a few other protocols. They would, you know, they could use something like this to do some of the testing with, you know, multiple people logging with SSH.
Totally.
As well as their websites could be kind of a all for one test for them. It supports authentication, so you could have it like log into your site. If your site had like a sign up form or whatever, it could sign up, register, right. log in, and browse the pages. It looks like Curl Loader is a, you know, one that you would have to kind of write scripts and kind of a little bit more work to get. This isn't like AB where you just kind of give it a URL and hit go.
Yeah.
But if you wanted to do some thorough testing, you could use this.
Right. Or, I mean, if you have, again, we're talking about if your application has different components in it, not just web and database, you know, maybe it has FTP, maybe it has, you know, any of that other stuff that curl can do, you know, maybe you want to test your performance of HTTP versus HTTPS. You know, you could do sort of load testing on those as well.
Yep. Another one is, we mentioned that Google is factoring page speed into their PageRank. Google Web, see, they changed their name. It's like Webmaster Central now, I think it's called. anyways, it's a Google place for webmasters. We've talked about it multiple times. Log into that, and on the left side, there's a spot where you can click your page load time, and you can kind of see an average. Whenever the spider goes to your site, it keeps track of how long it takes to load the site up. Now, I don't think the spiders actually grab very much JavaScript and a lot of those things, so it's not, you know, it may not be like totally what how long a like a the time reference might not be exactly what a user would the user right. might take a little bit longer to download because there's some more elements that it grabs, but it is a good average. This is what Google, you know, it's just whenever Google comes to your site, they're logging the time it takes to load the page, so this is a good thing to check in your average load time.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see things that, you know, I'm looking at mine right now. If you go to diagnostics and then hit crawl stats in the left-hand menu in the Google Webmaster thing, you can see, like, for some reason in mid, you know, early May or something, it looks like my website was really low. I mean, I'm really high for load time. But I don't know if it was like my web host or what. I mean, the three graphs for the thing seem to be very parallel. So it seems to be sort of host indicative, not anything I can do with my code or anything, but, also useful as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I believe you could probably look there. I believe it has like a baseline where you should be and where you're currently at. Like,
I don't
if
see
you're
any
doing
on the
well,
graph, but who knows?
Anyways, that is a good one to check because you know it's just there. It's tracked over a period of time, you know, a month or so. So, let's get into the web apps. Are web apps are actually related to this topic? They're both load testers?
Yeah. So the first web app we have is called Load Impact. So both of these are solutions that you can pay for. What's cool about Load Impact is they have like a free test, which, you know, has a, you know, it'll test up to 50 users. You know, run a simple load test with 50 concurrent simulated users. So again, not like using Selenium or anything like that advanced. I think it's just users that are gonna maybe like crawl through your website. It might look for links on your website and just kind of pretend to be like clicking around on your website. Up to 50 users for free. So you can go to that website right now, loadimpact.com, and just put in your website. And, you know, get a free test, and it's up to 50 users. And if you want to pay for more, you can pay for more because they can do up to more load tests for free. The tests run really fast, give you kind of a nice graph, really nice, simple little web app that just kind of does simple, like, just hitting your website testing, kind of what we were talking about, but does it from, like, sort of distributed things and simulates, you know, up to X amount of users.
Cool.
Yeah, so check it out. Loadimpact.com. The next one we want to talk about is browsermob.com. They actually have a load testing section. They have kind of a suite of tools, but the one we want to look at is load testing. And this one is cool because it's a little bit more advanced. It's not quite just sort of users hitting your website like we had with Load Impact. This one you can actually put in really simple scripts to simulate just people hitting your website, but you can also upload Selenium scripts. So kind of like we're talking, this is the one we're talking about, where if you have a Selenium script already, you can upload to it. It also has kind of an interesting plan where based, I think, on the number of users you want to load test and stuff, it gives you $10 for free, you know? So like your basic sort of 50 user test or whatever is $2.50. So you can run a couple tests for free. But it's not like the other one where you just, you know, you have a free test with only 50 users, but you have to pay for more. This you can kind of build up and pay as you go. So like if you just want to do one really big heavy test with a bunch of users, you can just kind of pay enough to get that done and then use little tests. But I think the really killer feature to this is I think this is just sort of like a Selenium grid, you know, that someone has built that is big.
Yeah. I mean, if you already have the Selenium, you know, tests that you've already written for your site and just, I mean, how easy is it? You know, to upload to these guys and have them run it against like 5,000 computers or 5,000 virtual users.
Yeah.
It's pretty easy. So, and I ran this one and it gives you a nice little graph of the throughput and the response times at various loads. I did 2,410 transactions.
Wow.
On my site. So
I did 561.
And it shows, it's pretty cool. Like baseline response time was 750 milliseconds, and then when it got really loaded up, it was a second and a half. So, yeah.
And you can actually also, when you get a test result with this, which is really cool, is download a MySQL data dump. So you can download the MySQL data dump, put in your own MySQL server, write an app against it or something if you want to try and like do metrics yourself or anything. So pretty cool. Check it out at browsermob.com. All right. Well, that wraps up for this episode of Face Off. I hope this episode will help you guys think about and maybe try doing some load testing on your applications. I know we'll be doing it on our application here pretty soon, see what we can handle. I want to remind you guys that if you haven't subscribed to the show, you can go to faceoffshow.com/subscribe and subscribe there. We have RSS. You can subscribe through iTunes, all kinds of ways. And if you have an idea or want to leave feedback for the show, go to faceoffshow.com/feedback. Tweet us out. Send us an email. Anything we'd like to hear from you guys. So let us know. Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really appreciate it. We will see you guys next week.